This is day two of this four-day December 2015 session, and I'm going to be continuing to read from this book of comments and talks of Sheng Yen, Master Sheng Yen, written by John Crook, entitled Illuminating Silence. And I'm going to start here. This section is called Day One Evening Lecture. And Sheng Yen says, I have only been in your country for a day, but already I have learnt something about you people. You have a love for ancient things. This house is hundreds of years old. You treasure the old worm-eaten beams and the crumbling stone walls, the bent timbers of the old barn. In Taiwan, we are busily engaged in pulling everything down and building up the new. In Chan, we treasure the old while making it always new. So it is appropriate here that I should talk to you about one of the oldest of the Chinese scriptures. I don't know what was happening in Britain in the 6th century. In China, it was the time of the Liang dynasty, which was from 502 to 556 AD. Buddhism was already established and Chan was developing. Yet in those early years, the Chinese did not distinguish too clearly between their own Taoist ideas and those of the new religion. So in this text, you will find a number of Taoist ideas which give a particular flavor to the Chan of that period. The text is so ancient that we are not sure who wrote it. He is known as Wang Ming, but that may be a pseudonym. His surname was Sung, and he served as a government official, but when the dynasty ended, he became a monk and took his vows under a Chan master. His intellectual ability implies that he studied theory with numerous teachers. Not sure about that sentence, but okay. Wang Ming emphasizes the unification of mind as especially important, and this goes back both to old Taoist notions and to the Indian idea of bringing the mind to single-pointedness. He calls his poem Calming the Mind, and it is a valuable one for beginners. It describes the method of practice and how to do it. Wang Ming advises us to let go of our anxieties and vexations and to let life unroll naturally. In the poem, mind can be used in two senses. As we shall see, the first usage refers to the worried mind of discrimination, the tense mind that needs to relax. It is this mind to which the title refers, that is, calming the mind. Yet when the mind becomes relaxed, what is the mind then? This is the second usage, a mind beyond illusion, discrimination, and the need to relax. Roshi Kaplow used to always make the distinction between mind with a capital M, mind with a small m. One of you has remarked how difficult it is to concentrate. Which mind are you trying to concentrate? We must be certain that we speak here of the mind of illusion that needs to become calm in order to see clearly. It is the mind that discriminates and then favors one thing more than another that always creates tensions. When you try to calm the mind, there are two important principles to observe. We need to be clear about these. The first is to cease worrying, and the second is not to be concerned with knowledge. To cease worrying, we have to trust. We have to trust the practice, the method, trust that we have the ability to carry out this practice, to benefit from it. Have to have to trust the process. It helps to understand that we're not directing it. This isn't something for us to control. And that's where you get into the second point of not being concerned with knowledge. It says, for your practice to be effective, you don't have to worry and you don't need to understand intellectually. We would like to be able to concentrate fully on our method, be it counting the breath, silent illumination, which of course is shikantaza, or working on a koan. Yet the more we try, the less concentration we achieve. Our minds simply do not obey our intentions. Wonder if anyone has had this experience. We try to stay with the method, but before we know where we are, the mind has drifted away onto something else. Our attitude is wrong somewhere. We feel frustrated and lost. Okay. This morning I asked you to leave behind for the moment all those people and events with whom you have been relating. We should stop thinking about the ongoing problems of our lives and relationships. Of course these things are important, and after the retreat, we shall take up such issues again. But here and now, in the retreat, we should let them go. Keep your distance from the past and the future. What is it that makes this so difficult? Mostly the thoughts that arise are concerned with the past, or perhaps with the future that will arise as a result of the past. This involves discrimination, judgment, comparison, and memory. It provokes an anxious tension that varies in strength according to the topic that comes up and your own disposition. It is vital to practice putting all this down. Just put it down. Had a an Indian friend, older friend. He had actually become a Jungian analyst and had before that practiced with a guru in India. He used to always say, just dismiss it from your mind. We have that ability. We can always dismiss it. We may not be able to keep the door locked. It may come back, but we have the difficulty, the ability to turn our attention. It never fails. Leave aside all past, all knowledge. With practice, you can let it go. When you can do this for as long as you wish, you have found a certain freedom. Indeed, this is not awakening, but to be able to control the mind, just to some degree, to get a little bit more ability to let things go and to place the attention on the practice or on whatever we're doing. This is huge. This is one of the main reasons to practice Zen, to come to Sesshin. Of course, we can't just do this during Sesshin. This is something we need to bring into our lives. Whenever I go and give a talk to high school students or college students, I mention what a joy it is to be able to just listen to music or watch a movie or whatever, just to have your mind on one thing. It's shouldn't be as rare as it is. He says, please do not misunderstand me. It is not that knowledge and experience are to be avoided or condemned. They are to be valued. But we need to gain control of their use. If we leave them to ramble haphazardly through our heads, sowing worries and agitation, then they become a burden to us, a vexation and an obstacle. Some people spend all night worrying. Others put aside their thoughts and sleep soundly. We need to cultivate the art of putting aside our memories, our concerns, and our intellectual knowledge. Napoleon who was famous for having said, of sleep, 2 hours for a man, 4 hours for a woman, 8 hours for a fool, had the ability to nap at a moment's notice, and he napped before many of his famous battles. Had this ability to put away his thoughts and sleep soundly. The first stanza of the poem reads, "Too much knowledge leads to overactivity. Better to calm the mind. The more you consider, the greater the loss. Better to unify the mind." And then he explains, "The more you know, the more things can cause you distress. When you know little, then you can be simple. In practicing, do not consider what you are doing intellectually or theoretically." Many people, when they are having difficulty in practice, feel they need to know more in order to practice more effectively. This usually doesn't help. Be better off knowing less. All you need to do is the practice. There it is. Use it to replace everything else. When you are confused and filled with conceptual fog, you may get depressed and struggle. It is important not to become too judgmental. In fact, any thought is illusory. It is never the thing in itself. Whatever you think is illusory. Illusion is normal. Why believe what you think? Do not be afraid of the rambling mind, nor condemn it angrily. The important thing is simply to recognize the state of thought that at that moment inhabits you. Recognizing an illusory thought will usually get rid of it. So helpful to have, to develop, to cultivate the ability to know what our mind is doing. So much of our thinking happens outside of our awareness. It's remarkable how far astray we can go and not even know it. So Roshi talks about the two sides of practice, mindfulness, awareness, and concentration. We need them both. You can have very strong concentration, and that can help take you far afield. You often see this at the final days of long sesshin. People can get into all kinds of amazingly ridiculous states just because they're just totally into whatever thoughts have invaded their mind. We need to be able to know what we're doing, where we are. Recognizing an illusory thought will usually get rid of it. To have an aversion to thought is to sustain yet another level of illusion. It's not a question of good and bad. We're not trying to meet some bar of performance. We're just trying to be aware. In Chinese, better to unify the mind can be translated as guard the one. What is this one? There are two meanings here. The first applies to the mind that is split up, discriminating, filled with illusory intellection. This mind needs to be focused, brought to a single point. Guarding the one means bringing the mind to this single place, and this is done through the method of practice. Training is portrayed in the Chan tradition by the parable of the ox herder. The ox has to be trained to do its job and not wander about over other people's gardens. To begin with, the ox herder must use his whip and apply discipline. Later, the ox is tamed, When eating, it eats. When drawing the plow, it pulls. It does the thing in hand without distraction. This is guarding the one. The ox is a wonderful metaphor for the mind. Just see it lumbering along, so much energy behind it, so much strength, turning its head off the path to munch the grass. So difficult to control. Once the mind has come to a single point, the term one acquires a further meaning. The mind is no longer practicing, it has arrived. The whip can be put away. Three things are happening. Body and mind are one. Internal and external are unified. And previous and subsequent thoughts are continuous. That last sentence is a little hard to understand. Might be easier just to say past and future are cut off, but I'll let him explain. No longer is there an experience of the mind being separate from the body. No longer is the observer separate from the observed. Experience flows without time being split into now and then. It's just another statement of those three criteria. Three things happening. There's no observer apart from the observed. His body and mind are one. Experience flows without time being split into now and then. Previous and subsequent thoughts are continuous. These three conditions arise together. If one is present, so are the others. Once the mind is unified, the one is guarded. I am sure those of you who have participated in several retreats have had some experience of this. And this is true. Just it isn't that unusual to get into a state of flow, basically. Psychological term. Can be to varying degrees. Sometimes we have, at least this was certainly the case for me, we have this exalted picture of what it would be for us to be in a state of oneness, and we don't realize that the mind does become gradually unified as we wean ourselves away from discrimination and from thoughts. And as this happens, our body and mind change, our experience changes. We begin to feel an energy that comes up from we don't know where. The mind begins to fall silent. This is not esoteric. This is not particularly unusual. It just requires the dedication of assiduously putting aside our thoughts, returning to the practice, the willingness, and the faith. The willingness to be okay with things as they are. Such a huge hindrance to be fixated on where you're going. These are thoughts of the future. This whole setting up a goal and having a criteria to judge how well you're doing, this is one of the biggest obstacles that people face in their practice. When you're continually critical, continually thinking my practice isn't good enough, my concentration isn't clear enough, my koan isn't vivid enough, all of that is turning away from practice. That's all it does. It just makes it that much harder for us to move along with the process to a state that's different. It's an annoying kibitzer getting in the way. He says, no longer is there an experience of the mind being separate from the body. No longer is the observer separate from the observed. Experience flows without time being split into now and then. These three conditions arise together. Then he goes to the next stanza. Excessive thinking weakens the will. The more you know, the more your mind is confused. A confused mind gives rise to vexation. The weakened will obstructs the Tao. Again, do not fall into the mistaken belief that Chan is anti-intellectual. I myself have persevered in scholarly studies and looked into theories and explanations, and so have many of you. These lines refer to the inappropriateness of thinking in the context of practice. Sometimes somebody comes to me with an answer to a koan. I may ask them from where they got it. Sometimes it obviously comes from a book. The answer has been a consequence of knowledge of thinking. It is not an answer arising from a mind free of illusion. This is not wisdom. If you are relying on books or theories or other people's descriptions, you can never solve a koan. The wisdom of the book is not the wisdom of seeing. If you deliberate, you are far from the mark. If you are far from the mark, you are confused, and there will be vexation. If there is intellectual doubt, there is only faulty awakening. We don't figure it out. We look. Next section is entitled Day 2, Early Morning Talk. He's almost caught up with us here. I have three words for the day. These words are isolation, non-dependence, non-attachment. The purpose of these words is to give you a focus for attention within your practice and awareness from moment to moment, whether in sitting or in relation to the group while you are working or eating. Isolation means keeping yourself separate from the environment and from others. Isolation is an attitude of practice. Even though you are sitting and working with others, let it be as if you were the only one here, and as if there was only one sitting place in the meditation hall, in the whole building. It is as if you are alone, a solitary practitioner in the mountains. It is important sometimes to withdraw and to be solitary, to be isolated and separate. Usually we are in constant interaction with the environment, our everyday worlds. We're disturbed by the ongoing concerns of the world, the news bulletins, politics, new taxes, old commitments. All this involvement causes us to lose touch with our basic being. We get filled with the noise of the world. As Tennyson says, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. If you isolate yourself in practice from past and from future, just being present, then you can see your self nature more easily without interference. As you go into this, you may eventually isolate yourself from previous thought and again from subsequent thought. As you withdraw from your own thoughts, you begin to discover what the independent, unconditioned self is. The second word, non-dependence. By non-dependence, I mean not being concerned with what others are thinking, doing, or saying. Most of our lives are spent in some sort of adjustment to other people whom we want to influence in some way. Maybe we want to please somebody, or we feel obliged in some way, or we owe somebody a favor, or we may want to reject or harm somebody. We are driven by our involvement with others and cannot let go. This is dependency. When we let ourselves be ourselves, we are not involved with others. We may still be concerned about other people, but not dependent on their thoughts, attitudes, or opinions. Even here on a retreat with the rules of silence and such, where it would seem easy to be free of dependency, you may not find it so. You may be aware of others' attitudes. You may develop feelings of attraction or repulsion towards another. You may be concerned with whether I am thinking well or unfavorably about you. You are not independent in your inner self. You are still bound by habits of dependence, which you are throwing out around you as you sit or as you work. If this is the case, notice it. Separate yourself. Find a mind that is not dependent on others. Even if you are afraid of loneliness, you need to experiment with this to make progress. I'm going to read something here from our old friend Anthony DeMello. I think he has a black belt in not being dependent on other people. He says, we all depend on one another for all kinds of things, don't we? We depend on the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Interdependence, that's fine. We set up society this way, and we allot different functions to different people for the welfare of everyone so that we will function better and live more effectively, at least we hope so. But to depend on another psychologically, to depend on another emotionally, what does that imply? It means to depend on another human being for my happiness. Think about that, because if you do, the next thing you will be doing, whether you're aware of it or not, is demanding that other people contribute to your happiness. Then there will be a next step, fear of loss, fear of alienation, fear of rejection, mutual control. Perfect love casts out fear. Where there is love, there are no demands, no expectations, no dependency. I do not demand that you make me happy. My happiness does not lie in you. If you were to leave me, I will not feel sorry for myself. I enjoy your company immensely, but I do not cling. I enjoy it on a non-clinging basis. What I really enjoy is not you. It's something that's greater than both you and me. It's something that I discovered, a kind of symphony, a kind of orchestra that plays one melody in your presence, but when you depart, the orchestra doesn't stop. When I meet someone else, it plays another melody, which is also very delightful. And when I'm alone, it continues to play. There's a great repertoire, and it never ceases to play. It's so helpful in Sesshin to have so many people with us. It really makes it so much easier to follow the schedule. If anyone has ever done a solitary retreat, they know it's hard. It can be done, but it's difficult. But we need to have this sense of being a solitary practitioner. It's really helpful. We get sort of the best of both worlds. We have the support, and yet we have the isolation. We have the ability to go deeply into our mind, not to be pulled away by considerations of what other people are doing or thinking, not comparing ourselves to others. This is so deadly. I spent so much time doing this in my early practice, just obsessing over the fact that other people were no doubt doing better than I was. You know you've made progress when you hear about somebody else's good fortune and it makes you happy. And you know there's a problem when you hear about somebody else's good fortune and it makes you reflect bitterly on your own condition. There's even a word for it in Sanskrit. It's called mudita. Taking joy in the success, the joy of others. But it is it is a problem, whether it's giving up our attachment and concern and involvement with other people, or even just giving up our thoughts. There's a loneliness that can come over us, and we definitely need to go into that. We need to not run away from it. That loneliness is only temporary. There's something more that goes way beyond dependence on others, dependence on thoughts. Shengyan says, you need to train yourself so that at any time and at any moment you choose, you can free yourself inwardly from your world, from others, from the past, from the future, from the previous thought and the next thought. That is to find freedom. Yet if you then think you are free and have some wisdom, this is not so. You should not be attached to solitude or to experiences of relative freedom. When you are attached neither to independence nor to company, then wisdom will manifest. Isolation and independence constitute non-attachment. I mean non-attachment to yourself, to the devices by which you make yourself safe. When you go beyond this illusory safety, you find freedom and wisdom. And from wisdom, as you look at the world, comes compassion. Sashin is a great place to experiment with going beyond our illusory safety. So many things that we can easily in Sashin develop a way of getting through it. You know, if I rest here and use these kinds of cushions and do this and do that, you know, I can make it through. And Sashin can become a preoccupation with getting through Sashin. Really miss out on so much if you limit yourself. It's very understandable, and early Sashin, just to get through, seems amazing. You know, I remember that very well. But I'm speaking more to veterans who now have their habits, their ways of doing things, and it helps. It helps immensely to shake it up a little bit. Get up in the middle of the night if you've never done that before. Skip a meal, especially if you've never done that before. Come early to the Zendo. You know, a lot of people, when the bell rings, they sort of manage to fuss around and do this and that so they don't make it in here any too early. It's a different spirit when the bell rings and you just find yourself walking to the Zendo. What else is there to do? If you're really thirsty, sure, you can get a drink of water, but I wonder how many times we do that just to sort of fill a little bit of time. The next section is called Day 2 Lunchtime Remarks. So now we're a little ahead. He's gotten ahead of us here. Whether we can get to that stage where the mind and body are united within practice depends on whether we can relax our tensions and allow the body to be at ease. This is a point that the Chinese stress a lot more than the Japanese, and I think it really is a good addition to the advice we get in sitting. If we can relax our tensions and allow the body to be at ease. It says, this is like learning to ride a horse. For a beginner, the motion of the horse is very tiring. Even for an accomplished equestrian, if the horse is a wild one, the rider can have an exhausting time. Yet for a beginner with a tamed horse or a skilled rider with a wild one, the riding can become comfortable and effortless. The rider and the steed are one. There is no feeling of struggle or separation. Of course, here the rider is the mind, the horse is the body. If the body is having a hard time, getting tired of sitting, for example, then we feel fatigued from effort. Yet when the method runs along smoothly, We forget about the body and mind because they are united. We feel pleasant and relaxed. When we meditate for long periods, it is important to forget the body. Likewise, in retreat, when we have a task to do, just do it, and do not be concerned with how the mind feels. So a lesson I learned late in life is not to worry so much about how the mind feels. In daily life, that's extremely helpful. When I was young, when I was a teenager, I was incapable of calling up a store on the telephone just because I was so shy, I guess. And I would want to screw up my courage and get in the right state before I did something like that, or heaven forbid, asked a girl out, or any of those things. It seemed like, how can I do that when I'm, you know, when I'm feeling fearful? And then somewhere in the course of Zen practice, I realized, oh, it doesn't matter. You can be fearful and do it. The body can do it, and the mind just comes along for the ride. And then the mind changes. If we have a task to do, just do it, and do not be concerned with how the mind feels. If the mind is scattered when we are doing a task, then many thoughts arise, one after the other. The mind separates from the action of the body. If we concentrate on the task, just performing it, cutting up the carrots, cleaning the table, sweeping the floor, then we are unaware of the mind. So work period in Sesshin is potentially extremely valuable. I wonder how many people are able to really see it as a practice opportunity. So many of the jobs in Sesshin are excellent for getting the mind out of the way. And what we learn there carries over into our daily life. So many things we do in our normal life that don't require a whole lot of mental input. Driving a car, raking the yard, washing the dishes, brushing our teeth. Just to do these things without the constant drip, drip, drip of thoughts, it's joyful, it's wonderful to do. It's the flavor of practice. It's the reward of practice. So on the first day of retreat, most people are not accustomed to the schedule. Now that it is the second day, whether meditating or doing your task, let your mind and your actions become one. Don't allow them to become separate. The next stanza that he gets into is, don't say there is no harm in this. The ensuing pain may last forever. Don't think there is nothing to fear. The calamities churn like bubbles in a boiling pot. This is, of course, the previous stanza. For those who may not remember, excessive thinking weakens the will. The more you know, the more your mind is confused. A confused mind gives rise to vexation. The weakened will obstructs the Tao. So don't say there is no harm in this. The ensuing pain may last forever. Don't think there is nothing to fear. The calamities churn like bubbles in a boiling pot. Wang Ming does not intend us to take him lightly. He is very much in earnest. He says that if we cannot put down the habit of reasoning, of turning our knowledge over and over, then we cannot obtain the benefits of meditation. To continue with such a habit constitutes a serious problem. As we say in our chanting, to seek great mind with thinking mind is certainly a grave mistake. No one should think there is nothing to fear. Rather, you should know that such a habit generates harm that can continue indefinitely. In the sutras, there is a particular term which points at our capacity for tolerating this world of suffering. Although we recognize that this is a world of suffering, we continue to put up with it. Not only that, we are willingly tolerant of suffering. We remain attached to the concerns of worldly life, the worries, the vanities, and the discriminations we use to judge one another. This is a world where we endlessly cope with suffering and rarely go beyond it. Likewise, a practitioner of Chan may know very well that wandering discursive thoughts are potentially harmful, but nonetheless, she may remain positively attracted to them. After all, they are amusing. When told not to entertain such tantalizing ideas and to think of nothing, the practitioner soon finds practice very boring. For example, we have agreed not to talk to one another. We know very well that talking causes us to lose our meditative focus. Nonetheless, situations arise in which a few remarks are passed. We cannot resist prolonging the interaction with a few more words in reply. It seems such an enjoyable thing. If we are indeed serious about practice, we should not think lightly of these warnings. If we heed them, we can go beyond knowledge, and true practice can begin. In sitting, it is remarkable to me, looking at my own practice, how routinely one can tolerate a little bit of thinking. We can just idly play with a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It feels like a radical step to really let the thoughts go, to really be disciplined about it. It takes an effort, and no one really wants to make an effort. We have to recognize there is some resistance. It can come in a lot of forms. It can just seem daunting. Remember just imagining what would it be like to be completely unified with the koan for hours at a time. You know, how on earth could I maintain that, sustain that? It just shows you how deluded I was. Why think in those terms? Why look at hours? All we need to do is take care of this moment. Don't have to solve problems in the future. It's awareness in the present. It's all that's necessary. And that awareness in the present is not difficult. It isn't hard in this moment to switch our attention to the koan or the breath, whatever the practice is. It's true, it's very hard to sustain that, but we can do it. We can turn the mind. Maybe we succeed in clearing a space for 5 seconds, the length of one breath. Whatever it is, it's good. Can extend that gradually. It becomes more normal. The resistance starts to fade. We're not doing something that's unpleasant. It's not unpleasant to be free of thoughts. Begin to sense that there's some energy there that comes up when we take that step. We begin to experience the fruits of meditation, the joy of practice. But it's such a mare's nest, it's such a mess, because we're always trapped into thinking about our practice. This is good, that's bad, I'm a failure, I'm a success. It's just more thoughts, it's just more thinking. It's not good or bad. It's just something that has a consequence, something that determines our experience. We need to work from where we are. We need to be okay with the fact that we've spent so many rounds of sitting, just playing with our thoughts. Realize that we have this opportunity. Need to give ourselves the permission to enjoy our practice. To take the burden of guilt, of measurement, of concern with other people's judgments, to let those things go. We can do this. Every time we sit down, we have an opportunity to do this. This is the incredible promise of Sesshin, the ability to really get in the trenches and deal with this stuff. Why waste time thinking, oh, I've never done well at this at all, I'm no good at it? Where does that go? It goes nowhere. It's just silly. It's totally unnecessary. You know, I often say to people, if beating yourself up improved your performance, I would be all for it. My experience is that it doesn't. We're now in the middle of day two. This is, in most sessions, truth in advertising here, this is a tough day. The body is, you know, adjusting to this new and somewhat more rigorous schedule. And we can struggle with sleepiness. Thoughts can be bubbling up nonstop. But if we just keep going, if we just don't worry about it, it's not our problem. You know, if there is a storm, there's a storm. If there's heat, there's heat. The wind blows, the wind is blowing. So many other people with us. Opportunity is here. Let's just do it. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.